Good morning, and thank you all for holding. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's conference. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. I would like to remind all parties the call now is being recorded. If you have any objections, to please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Glenn Nowak. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us this afternoon for a brief update on the H1N1 vaccine situation and influenza across the country. Doing today's update will be Dr. Ann Schuchat. She is the director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, and I will turn the podium over to Dr. Schuchat for a brief update. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. We'll try to keep this relatively short. I want to let people know a little bit more about what we're learning about the H1N1 disease in people and a quick snapshot of where we are with the vaccination program. As we noted on Friday, the H1N1 influenza is pretty much throughout the country with unusual levels of illness for this time of year. We've had 5 more pediatric deaths reported to us since the last time I briefed. So, again, tragic consequences for a lot of children. We've been looking in more detail at hospitalization data. We have something called the Emerging Infections Program Network, 10 states that do active surveillance for influenza-related hospitalizations, and we've been trying to update information on patients that are requiring hospitalization from the H1N1 virus. So the data that I'm going to summarize come from reports to that Emerging Infection Program Network, and we'll summarize information from cases that occurred from April all the way through the end of August. Last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a summary of the first 272 hospitalized H1N1 patients from around the country. This is a bigger sample of what we're seeing. The majority of people do have underlying conditions. That's true both in children and in adults. We have information for about 1,400 hospitalized adults and over 500 children who required hospitalization for the H1N1 virus. We are still finding, as I said, most have underlying conditions. In adults, the most common underlying conditions were asthma and chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease, and immunosuppression. And in children, the most common underlying conditions were asthma and chronic lung disease, neurologic or neuromuscular diseases, and sickle cell or other blood disorders. Again, we are seeing pregnancy as quite notable among hospitalized patients. And in this, among the 1,400 hospitalized adults, 88% or 6% of them were pregnant. So just a reminder of why those conditions, pregnancy and underlying conditions, are ones that we highlight as recommended to receive the H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available in communities. So let me turn to the immunization program. As of yesterday, 9.8 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine were available to be ordered. 5.8 million doses had been ordered as of yesterday by the states to be shipped out. And we're getting new orders every day and new allotments of vaccine. So this is going to be a very dynamic circumstance. I'm happy to say that about half of the vaccine that's available for order is now the injectable form. Initially, you know, we only had the nasal spray available, but now it's about half and half that are available and will be coming out towards the states relatively soon. It does take time to process the orders, to package them for the right amounts that are heading out towards the many sites that will be delivering vaccine, and this is going to be ongoing over the next days and weeks. We're working closely both with the state and local health departments, with the professional societies, the physicians, nurses, nurse midwives, many of the organizations that serve high-risk patients, trying to make sure that we get good information out to the public, as well as these special population groups and the providers who care for them. We know that healthcare providers are really interested in what's going on with H1N1 as well as what's going on with the vaccination. We've been doing a lot of outreach calls and working through the professional societies to get good information out, and these efforts will continue. If there are providers who aren't sure how to be able to offer H1N1 vaccine, a reminder is you need to work with your state health department or in some of the larger cities, the city health department. you can enroll to become a provider who offers vaccine, and we're still taking enrollment through the different states. So look to either your either give your health department a call or look on their website. You can really have one-stop shopping at flu.gov. There's a map that goes to each state, and we'll have information on the contact, the way to contact the state health department about vaccination issues. Going forward, we will are expecting that more vaccine will be getting shipped out regularly. More places will begin vaccination efforts. Now that there are both spray forms of the vaccine and the injectable, there will be an ability to offer vaccine to people who aren't eligible for the spray. Only people between the ages of 2 and 49 who are not pregnant and don't have underlying conditions can receive the nasal spray. So this injectable form of vaccine means that many more will be available, that many more people can take advantage of the vaccine. This Friday, we hope to start providing state-specific information, so there'll be a better sense of just how much vaccine is in my is on its way to my own state. We'll also be updating on the disease at that time. We really know that the states and local health departments are working very hard right now to ramp up the vaccination activities. Things will be changing every day, and we just wanted to be available today to provide information for those of you with questions. The state and local health departments are going to be that best source of information on what's happening where you are in terms of disease or vaccination, but we want to be available for the national picture. So with that, I'd like to take the first question from the phone, please.
Thank you. Our first question is from Robert Basil from NBC News.
Because of all the interest in flu in general, in these big, many programs that were set up to give seasonal flu have been suddenly canceled. What do you say to the people who were expecting to get their seasonal flu on a certain date and then their church their, or whatever school or whatever facility suddenly had to shut it down?
You know, I wish it were easier for people who are looking for seasonal flu vaccine. We are aware that there are difficulties in many communities. The good news is 77 million doses have already been distributed, and lots of people have stepped up to be vaccinated. And the other side of the story is that there's a delay in more of the seasonal flu vaccine getting out in a lot of areas. We're expecting a lot more doses in November. The main message I have is to be patient. Right now what we're seeing is the H1N1 strains. We aren't seeing much at all of the seasonal strains, and we think there's time to be vaccinated against seasonal flu vaccine. Even if vaccine isn't more available till November or December, we think it'll be just fine to be vaccinated then. So really, I'd like to apologize for how frustrated this is for you and ask for your patience in waiting for more of the seasonal vaccine. Fortunately, some of the H1N1 vaccine is coming out, and we think it's going to be really important to get that out to people as quickly as we can. Next question from the phone, please.
Our next question is from Craig Schneider from Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I think a lot of people are expecting that the H1N1 vaccine shots are going to be available this week, widespread in the United States, but we're just seeing that almost nobody has the shots yet. Are you anticipating, are you seeing any delays in the delivery of the shots, and when would you expect that it'll be out there for widespread use?
You know, I expect more and more doses to be available each day, but widespread use will probably be towards the end of the month. Now, certainly this week, the shots will be out in all the states, or most of the states, I believe, but not in the large, large numbers that we'll be looking for later in the month. And each of the states and cities is directing the vaccine to the places where it can be given quickly, to high-risk populations or to healthcare workers, to children and school children in some communities. The states and locals are really trying to take the doses that are available to them and find focused, practical ways to get them used promptly. So week by week, there'll be lots more vaccine coming. We were glad that it's, you know, almost 10 million doses that were available for order as of yesterday, but I know that you won't see it everywhere until later in the month. The next question from the phone, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Miriam Falco from CNN Medical News.
Thank you for taking the questions. Is there any way for folks to who are curious about where their states are making these shots available that they could go to a central place? I mean, I know that each state is running it differently, but are you providing any links on FluView? Because we're getting the same questions, too.
Right.
When are the shots coming here?
Yes. So the at flu.gov, there's a flu vaccine locator place that basically will say for each state what the latest information is. Now, we are expecting states to be publicizing the vaccination that's going to be offered generally or for, you know, for anybody who's recommended to come and get. But the private offices that are providing vaccine probably won't be listing themselves on that site. They'll be offering vaccine to their patients, but not to the general community. So the school-located venues will likely be posted there, the retail pharmacies, the hospitals that are offering them, but probably not those doctors' offices, because we're really asking, you know, grateful that so many providers are stepping up to do this, but we're asking them to vaccinate their patients. We're not asking them to, you know, shut down their practice for that week and offer it to everybody else in the community. We are grateful for the many providers of all specialties that are stepping up to this, and we urge more to do so. It's not too late to sign up with your state to become a provider who offers vaccine, whether you're a retail pharmacy or a doctor's office or a hospital. So the short answer, though, is that flu.gov, you can find the central information that will tell you about any state, and people then can be directed to their state. Okay, next question from the phone.
The next question is from Helen Branswell from the Canadian Press.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much for taking my question. Dr. Shuket, you said earlier that you've looked at the about 1,400 hospitalized adults and 500 hospitalized children. I'm wondering, do you find that women are overrepresented in your figures? There was a study published by JAMA yesterday looking at critical care cases in Canada. And even after you sort of factor out pregnancy, women seem to be overrepresented, and I'm wondering if you're seeing it there too.
You know, this recent look at hospitalizations is, I just have the underlying disease information. I don't have the female-male proportions. I believe we haven't been seeing a major difference, but we'll look into that and try to get you more information on that. So I don't have the latest on that. Next question from the phone.
Our next question is from David Brown from the Washington Post.
Yeah, thanks again, as always. This is sort of following Helen's question, do you have or can you provide us today some demographic breakdown and some details of these of the from April series of hospitalized patients? Because obviously there's lots of interest in, you know, what fraction were obese and what the age range was and what the mortality was and all that stuff.
Today, all I will have is the underlying diseases, but these are just the kinds of information we'll be able to get you. I pushed to be able to get something new for you, and what I got was underlying diseases. As we've been seeing, the vast majority of hospitalizations and deaths are occurring in younger people. They're not occurring in people 65 and over. That hasn't changed at all in what we've been looking at. But the latest numbers on the breakdown of diseases, it doesn't separate. It's just 18 and over and under 18 that I have.
Okay. Can I just ask an unrelated follow-up question? When will the injectable vaccine, when will the first supplies of that be shipped to states and cities?
You know, I think it's happening right now. I believe there'll be sites that are giving injectable vaccine this week. So we know that people were ordering injectable, I think, and that there's been shipments both yesterday and actually I think Sunday and Monday shipments were going out. So I'm pretty sure that there'll be injectable doses given probably tomorrow and definitely the next day. Next question from the phone, please.
Our next question is from Mike Stope from the Associated Press.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I too have a question about the hospitalization data. Doctor, can you just give a little detail on the underlying conditions? Could you give us a percentage, and also could you put this new information in context? Is this the largest data pool we've had on U.S. hospitalizations, and is there any difference in your finding about what percent of underlying conditions as compared to previous looks?
What we're seeing is consistent with the early look that we did, the 272 patients hospitalized. We do see some people without underlying conditions, and we're still analyzing these data, but our findings are very consistent with the early look. In terms of adults, asthma made up 26% of the adults who were hospitalized had asthma. About 10% had diabetes. 8% had other chronic lung disease besides asthma. 7.6% had immunosuppressive conditions, and 6.1% were pregnant. So those were the specifics on the adult numbers. And, yes, this would be the largest for the U.S. experience of adults hospitalized, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't missing some important underlying conditions that we hadn't talked about earlier. You know, in terms of children, one thing to make a mention of, because I'm not sure we've mentioned it before, is the sickle cell or other disorders of blood, the hemoglobinopathies. You know, those are conditions for which we do recommend influenza vaccine. They've been on that ACIP recommendation list for years. But we found that of the children in our hospitalization series, 5.8% had a hemoglobinopathy, the most common of which is sickle cell disease. So these data aren't very different from the earlier ones, but because we have larger numbers, we're feeling more comfortable that the vast majority of underlying conditions that are risk factors for this severe consequences like hospitalizations are included in the list of groups that we've recommended to be vaccinated. Next question from the phone, please.
Our next question is from Brian Hartman from ABC News.
Yeah, hi, Admiral. We're hearing reports that some hospitals are beginning to advise against children visiting patients, and just wondering what you think about that, and does the CDC have any guidance on limiting pediatric visitors to hospitals? And then a quick follow-up question, if you've learned anything at all about obesity as an underlying condition from the surveillance data you just talked about.
I don't have the obesity data for this hospital series, but it's one of the things we are looking at in more detail. In terms of hospital practices, you know, hospitals are really looking carefully at ways that they can reduce transmission of influenza in the hospital environment. And among those are administrative controls, the ways that we can keep people who are ill separate from other people, whether those are people who are ill in the hospital, people who are in the emergency department and coughing, or perhaps visitors. And so I don't believe CDC has any recommendations about changing the practice of children visiting hospitals, but certainly hospitals are taking a careful look at their own facilities. There's a lot about the structure of a facility that, you know, how crowded it is and how many places people can be that might lead them to take that kind of step. We know that hospitals are really, some of the hospitals have had quite a challenge handling quite a lot of ill people over a short period of time, and I think that they're working hard to be ready for increases in illness in the months ahead. Next question from the phone, please.
Our next question is from Elizabeth Weiss from USA Today.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. A question about the pregnancy as an underlying condition. Do we have any sense of what the mechanism is for why pregnant women are at greater risk than, I mean, someone with asthma makes sense, but what is it about pregnancy that puts you at risk?
There are probably two factors that influence the risk that pregnant women have for influenza complications, and this applies to both seasonal flu and the H1N1 flu. In pregnancy, there's a change in the immune system, which makes it easier for the woman to hold the fetus and not have a immune reaction to the baby. And so risk of infections can be greater. The second issue is probably more mechanical, that as the womb gets larger with the baby growing, there can be pressing on the airways and really a restrictive lung disease. So it's harder to take a deep breath, and it's harder to fight off a lung infection, especially in the later stages of pregnancy. So both of those two factors, we think, are part of the story here. And, of course, the really difficult complications of pregnancy have been, I think, one of the features of this pandemic that, of course, make us remind women that if you have respiratory symptoms, fever and cough, please take them seriously during your pregnancy and let your healthcare provider know about them. Prompt use of antiviral medicines may be very important in that circumstance. And if you're pregnant, it's a really good time to find out about the vaccine and get your questions answered, because vaccination is the best way to protect yourself and the baby from the complications of flu. And there are, you know, many, many people get influenza vaccine every year. Seasonal flu vaccines used in about 100 million people. The H1N1 vaccine is made exactly the same way as the seasonal flu vaccines, And we think the safety, including the safety in pregnancy, should be excellent. So I strongly encourage pregnant women to talk to their providers about this and really get your questions answered in the next several days and weeks while you're waiting for the vaccine to be available near you. Next question from the phone.
Our next question is from Betsy McKay from the Wall Street Journal.
Hi, Dr. Shuket. Thanks. I also have a question from your surveillance data of the hospitalizations, which we're so glad you're sharing with us. I wondered if you know how many of these hospitalized adults and children had no underlying conditions at all, you know, or i.e. perfectly healthy. And separately, do you have insights yet into what is making some of these people with no underlying conditions so sick? I mean, a lot of people out there are wondering, you know, could this happen to me? And when, you know, when should they call the doctor?
Thank you. These data are preliminary, and I have to say I rushed to get them for you. So what I can say is that the pediatric data needs to be looked at a little bit in more detail because we haven't pulled out those children under two who, of course, have their – just being under two is really like a underlying condition for having a complication from influenza. But in the adult group, it was more than 45% actually didn't have an underlying condition that's listed on the ACIP list of underlying conditions. We're still looking into what proportion of them may have had severe, you know, morbid obesity or extreme obesity, but it was the majority that had at least one underlying condition. And then the second question you had, about what's the mechanism. Yeah, I think a key point is that this virus can be serious, even in healthy people with no underlying conditions. We have seen and reported results from the autopsies that have been looked at. That was reported a couple weeks ago in the MMWR. And there were two patterns in these terrible fatalities that we've had from H1N1. One was a viral pneumonia, a very severe, the virus really overwhelming the lungs on its own. That is not the most common manifestation of H1N1 influenza in people, but it can happen. And when it can happen, even a healthy young person can really succumb to it. It's a very severe presentation. In about 30% of the fatalities, what we saw was the influenza leading to a bacterial pneumonia, a very intense bacterial pneumonia. Sometimes it was the Staph aureus, including the MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Sometimes it was the pneumococcus, and that's where we're telling people, remember that pneumococcal vaccine, which is so important in protecting people from pneumococcal pneumonia that can follow influenza. But so what I would say is that most people who develop H1N1 influenza will have an illness that can be cared for at home without needing to seek care, without needing treatment. But some people will have a very severe course. And so if you have warning signs, difficulty breathing, if your child, if your parent notices that your skin is turning a little gray or blue, that you're not taking feeding, that it's difficult to wake you up, that you're just so irritable that you can't stop crying, those are warning signs in children. Warning signs or respiratory symptoms and fever in someone with an underlying condition or pregnancy are reasons to seek care or talk to your health care provider. So I think it is sobering that some totally healthy people suffer this very rapid deterioration from the H1N1. That is not the usual presentation, but it can happen. And as this strain spreads around the country, the numbers of people suffering from that have been increasing. We have time for two more questions.
Our next question is from Tom Chow from LA Times.
Tom Mao. To clarify on this 1,400 adults and 500 children, that is just from the 10 surveillance states, and the percentages you gave, those are from this study or from the previous study?
The data that I described today is just from the Emerging Infection Program Network states. They're either whole states or counties within a state. So this is not the national picture because we basically aren't recording data on every hospitalization in this level of detail. What we're doing now is intensifying the surveillance in those Emerging Infection Program Network sites so that we have better clinical data to share. The percentages were just from this series, not from the national picture or what we had talked about earlier. So all of these hospitalizations occurred in one of the emerging infection program network sites, and the underlying diseases were gathered through these partnerships that we have with the state health departments and the some universities in those emerging infection program network sites. So this is one of our special surveillance systems that we've been put in place a few years ago as part of strengthening our preparedness for influenza, including for pandemic influenza. These same EIP network sites will be looking at vaccine effectiveness, and they'll also be looking at some of the adverse events that might follow vaccines. So you'll be hearing more from us about what we learn from the Emerging Infection Program Network sites, and we're really grateful for the collaboration out there from the state and local health departments and clinicians in those communities. I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you. And our final question is from Daniel Danoon from WebMD.
Thank you for taking my question. I've heard from some providers, particularly a large pediatric practice, that they've actually canceled their order for the H1N1 shots because the huge volume of paperwork that's larger than other vaccinations, and particularly because of a requirement that nurses, RNs or LPNs or even an MD must give the shots and not nurse assistants. Can you shed any light on this? Is this a problem that you're starting to see across the country?
Thanks for mentioning that. I hadn't heard about that problem. We really tried hard to provide, to limit the barriers to providers to be able to offer vaccines. We've modeled the enrollment after the Vaccines for Children program, which has about 45,000 providers enrolled around the country to provide vaccines that are given through the government entitlement program. Certainly, some providers are going to be really busy caring for ill patients, and taking on vaccination can be difficult. We really urge people to reconsider. I hope that that's just a rare event, the one that you're hearing about. I haven't heard it commonly, but perhaps after this we'll hear more about that. And so I do want to thank all the providers and other sites that have enrolled to offer vaccine. You know, we are hearing that a lot of people want to be vaccinated, and of course, as a government, we're really committed to get enough vaccine out there and have a system where anyone who wants to be vaccinated is able to be over the months ahead. So I want to just end maybe by thanking all those who are stepping up to be providers and if they're not providing, to carefully refer people to places where they will be able to be vaccinated. So thanks, and we'll have another one of these, I believe, on Friday.
And this concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.